Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Science Studio program. And I thought it would be interesting to go to the top of the university pyramid and talk to the president of a university who's experienced in science, knows a lot about science, and where our president would think current education is headed and where the good is and where the bad is, and have a discussion. And so, therefore, Professor Dr. Diana Natalicio, who is the president of the University of Texas at El Paso, is here in the studio, and we're going to talk about her ideas of science and see what sort of interesting ideas she has and where they can be correct, where they can be incorrect, and where we can have a conversation. So, Diana, thank you. Welcome, Science Studio.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, you're first and foremost in your career. You started out as a linguist. I think a little bit of the audience, or a lot of the audience, would be interested in knowing linguistics, and she's going to be talking about science, and she was on the National Science Board of the National Science Foundation. Tell us about linguistics as a sort of a discipline.
Well, I mean, linguistics is one of the social and behavioral sciences, and the range of specializations within linguistics is huge, and so you can study historical linguistics and try to trace the roots of current languages back to their origins and language families, that sort of thing. You can look at sociolinguistics in terms of the way in which people use language in different registers and different social milieu. But linguistics has become much more analytical and much more scientific, if you will, probably since Noam Chomsky and all of that came into play, and that was, of course, a very signature moment in the development of the field. And like most social and behavioral sciences, it is viewed as being at the periphery of core scientific disciplines from the point of view of the people who actually participate in those core disciplines. And so on the National Science Board, for example, there might be two or three of 24 members who would be social and behavioral scientists. The vast majority would be physicists and chemists and engineers. And the social and behavioral scientists would include economics and, you know, sociology, anthropology, and that sort of thing. So linguistics is part of what NSF defines as a science, and I think legitimately so. And so, you know, it's a field that I think a lot of students are quite interested in, many of them for cultural reasons. They find the study of linguistics to be very closely tied, which it is, to cultures. And so that moves you into anthropology and a lot of other related fields.
When you say there's two or three on the National Science Board in that particular sort of social science disciplines, did you have to fight a lot in order to get your voice and your opinion and your sort of concept of the direction of science to be a little bit more all-inclusive as opposed to the physicists and the scientists like chemists pushing?
I don't think we had to fight so much as to earn respect on the part of the other members of the National Science Board. They rather wondered what we were doing there. And especially in my case, I was appointed by President Clinton, and I was one of the few females on the National Science Board. I was from a university that wasn't part of the usual National Science Board menu of universities, so MIT, Harvard, you know, Cal Berkeley, different places like that. And I was in a field that was not considered to be central to the scientific enterprise as defined by most of the members of the board. So I think the important thing was to earn respect by demonstrating a willingness to learn and to contribute a perspective that was rational and thoughtful, and that would help the board see things perhaps in a slightly different way than they might otherwise. Now, in order to get them to listen, of course, you have to have earned some respect. And so I was there, I think, or what I had in mind while I was there was to be able to represent a constituency that the National Science Foundation was trying to include, which is historically black colleges and universities and other minority-serving institutions.
So you had two hats.
I had several hats, I would say, yeah. Okay. And I was trying very hard to ensure that institutions that might not have the resource advantages of some of the large, muscular, well-resourced institutions had an opportunity to expose their students to outstanding researchers, faculty, and facilities that would go with them. And so one of the important things that National Science Foundation and the National Institutes of Health and other federal agencies have been able to do is build capacity in those institutions by sponsoring students, by providing faculty with resources, by competitive grants for equipment and a lot of other things. So that was very, very exciting work for me.
And do you think that if you look back on the pre-Diana Natalicio interactions with the National Science Board, National Science Foundation, and today we've come a long way?
I think we've come a long way.
I don't mean the institution here,
but
in general, the nation.
I think we have come a long way, and I certainly don't – I'm not presumptuous enough to think that I had a major impact on that, but I was part of, I think, an effort to try to change the narrative so that it was more inclusive of people at institutions that perhaps hadn't had the kind of support historically. So we have made quite a lot of progress. I think we are seeing growth in the number of Latino scientists and engineers. We're seeing researchers at very high levels. And they are products in many instances of institutions like UTEP that are serving a largely minority student population. So I think we have made progress. We're not there, but we've made progress.
You know, this emphasis on STEM, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, does it have any negatives? I mean, you see, you know, we're spending so much money, national funding, on this area that I sometimes myself think that we're ignoring some of the other aspects of education. And I'm beginning, as I get older, to think that more people in the STEM area should also be studying more in detail some of those liberal arts areas that we really don't seem to have time to give them. And vice versa, the people over there in arts, let's just put it that way, the humanities, need more science. But I don't see much of a movement to be bringing these two together very much.
Well, I think that's probably true. I think the key is always balance and trying to achieve some balance so that people who study the humanities or social and behavioral sciences have exposure to science. If they're going into policy fields, for example, they have to understand some of the basics of the environment and what's affecting it and so on, because you can't really form policy or design systems if you're not understanding that. And I mean, more and more evidence is coming out that such things as national defense really do have to learn far more about the environment and the natural kind of ecosystems. I was just given a book by Jim Kubicki, the chair of geological sciences, called Connectography. And it's a book that addresses an issue that I've actually been interested in for a long, long time from a linguistic perspective, which is that political boundaries are artificially separating people, cultures, ecosystems, because they're totally arbitrary. They're designed by people who didn't pay any attention to any of that.
It's rather like the boundaries of African countries,
exactly.
Post-Britain, France, etc.
Exactly. Right. And that's true here in El Paso Juarez to a great extent. That boundary is a political boundary. It's not a natural ecosystem boundary or a people boundary or a cultural boundary. And so it's artificial, and there are consequences to that. And people need to understand these things, I think, better in order to formulate good policy or to vote intelligently. So I think it's a question of balance. I always worry when you get to one extreme or another. And most of the money, I think you're right, has in federal funding, has gone into the STEM area at the expense probably of other, you know, humanities and arts and so on. both the National Endowment for the Humanities and National Endowment for the Arts have suffered mightily in terms of their funding. They're always at the brink of being eliminated.
Right.
And so it's really, I think, a matter of balance. And we have a hard time with that because the advocates on one side and another speak so strongly and push so hard that there isn't room for compromise in the middle.
So going back to then your training as a social scientist, as a linguist, the scientific part of your training, how would you describe that to people like me that think of, unfortunately, laboratories, big instruments? What's the science part of the social science that you think it was crucial in your own career development? I mean, not lots of linguists get to be successful presidents and don't stay there for 25 years either.
True. I think, well, a couple of things are interesting. I think one is that certainly the scientific method, if you will, of analyzing data and managing data and drawing inferences from data and working on data is something that you definitely learn. You do analyses in linguistics, a lot of them. And there's a certain training associated with that, how you do that and how you think about those things.
Can I interject? Did you ever have mathematics classes?
Linguistics curriculum, no. But I'd had it before, not
as an undergraduate, right.
Yeah. Now, what's been interesting is I was quite interested at a certain point in language acquisition, and particularly I was interested in concurrent bilingualism, so children who grow up learning two languages and find no difficulty whatsoever in managing all of that. And the difference between that and learning a second language as an adult, which never really seems to take in quite the same way. And so we spent a great deal of time drawing inferences from examples of people, for example, maybe aphasic, people with aphasia who suffered some kind of brain damage, and you could infer from how this affected their language certain things about the brain. What's happened since the time I was trained and now is that we now have brain mapping. We have all kinds of scientific approaches. So linguistics has actually become much more, quote, scientific in the way that you talk about science as you know,
instrumentation.
Core. Yeah,
because
exactly.
It is the instrumentation in
it
many
is
ways.
The technology that makes it possible.
Yeah, that drives
right?
much of science. Physicists are always good at this. Physicists made little bits of equipment that did things like Raman spectroscopy or other things that chemists come along and say, oh, what a lovely tool. And we go forwards, leaps and bounds.
Yeah, that's right. No, and there is always that conversation about that kind of pairing of evolution of technology and then scientific breakthroughs.
Right.
And so linguistics is a totally different field today. I mean, many of the people working in our psychology department on neuroscience. I mean, that's basically linguistics is morphed into neuroscience in a very significant way.
I was just listening the other day to a program on the BBC when they were talking about people who have had strokes. And, you know, their articulation is almost disappeared. But when they sing, it can be perfectly well. And because one's left hand and the other's right hand, and if they sing enough, in fact, then slowly the plasticity of the brain begins to recuperate the other part of the language. And you're right. I mean, the instrumentation, and I suppose that's linguistics. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Professor Diana Natalicio. She is the president of the University of Texas at El Paso, and we'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Professor Diana Natalicio, linguist, member of the National Science Board for many years, and the president of the University of Texas at El Paso. We were talking about, you know, your training in the social sciences and the current state of funding, which is very, very high in science at the moment. It's a very expensive business to have a university trying to do good science. As we talked earlier, you need this instrumentation. You need the experts to run the damned instruments. I mean, I can't run half of the instruments that my research group use. And that brings me to expense and then cost. And education is getting quite expensive. All right. I mean, especially in certain regions of society where incomes are relatively low and stagnant, but along with medical care, education costs are going up. There's a suggestion. Make it all free and find out how we can pay for it. Give me your feeling about where we're going to have to go in terms of higher education and funding.
Well, I think first it's important to point out that UTEP has worked very, very hard to keep costs down. And a lot of the discussion about the rising cost of higher education is about private institutions with very plush facilities and that sort of thing, amenities more than facilities. And I think clearly, from my perspective, public higher education ought to be accessible to every talented young person, because I think that education is the ticket to a future, a bright future. I totally believe in that. It certainly was for me and for most of the people I know. If it hadn't been for education, I wouldn't be president of UTEP. I wouldn't live in the Hoover House or none of that.
Let me interject there, though, because that was always at a time, and still the implication is that there's a rather restricted number of people who are going to be into that higher education, all right? Whereas the other extreme says, look, let everybody come, all right? There's not going to be much of an advantage in general, because you're still going to need people to do the sorts of jobs that don't need the education, but you're going to have a better educated population, making better decisions at the polling booth, understanding where the society is going. So it's not always clear to me that the old saw that says the education is your way out, because that's assuming only a limited number of people can have that education.
No, I think it's your way in to a better life and a better society, because you are participating at a different level. And I do think that given the changes in the workforce and what people are being asked to do, more education is necessary. Now, does it have to be a baccalaureate degree? Not necessarily. You know, there are lots of options available. But I think what's important is that it be accessible, and that means affordability in the public sector. And I think that the public sector, I think we as a society have a responsibility to create educational opportunities that are affordable. And I don't think that it necessarily needs to be absolutely and totally free. That would be wonderful if we could do it. But I think that it is important that the state have skin in the game, that it be a part of a commitment that we make to our people, that education and health care and some of these other things that seem so difficult these days for people in the United States to have access to are really very, very important. And they're not just important to the people that I'm talking about. They're important for the rest of us, because they are going to contribute to a better quality of life for the rest of us. So we're all connected, you know?
If you look at certain European countries, Germany comes to mind. I think it's Slovenia also, where they've just said, look, higher education, free.
Right.
And not just free for people in Germany or Slovenia, but anybody. You know, so large numbers of American students are saying, well, you know, all I've got to do is find somewhere to live. And they're taking that opportunity. That is a really interesting development, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I think it's very enlightened. I mean, I think an enlightened population has many, many advantages. And for
one
all
hopes
of us,
so. Right?
Right? For
yeah.
all of us.
I mean, that's what we're all here for.
Exactly.
Right.
And so I think whether you're educated in the arts or in humanities, whatever it might be, you're going to contribute more as a result of that education.
Absolutely, I agree with that. The contribution is going to be high. Whether or not there's the outlet for your career that you expect when you go onto that train, I think that's the issue. And in fact, you know, they say today somebody graduating from high school or from university can expect multiple careers, all right? I've had one. That's going to be abnormal, I think.
Well, it has changed. The workplace has changed, definitely. And I think young people who are going into the workforce now have very different expectations about careers. And I think part of what we're struggling with really is that we are in a transitional time in terms of what work is. And, you know, it used to be when I graduated from high school in St. Louis, all of the boys in my high school, with a couple of exceptions, expected to become apprentices in a union and work for one of the big companies, Anheuser-Busch, Monsanto, all the big companies in St. Louis, and become part of the unions. And they were carpenters and plumbers and electricians and, you know, all of that, very worthy. But they were guaranteed a lifetime of employment and security and retirement. That's no longer the pattern that most young people are facing today. Very few do.
Do you think there's an argument that says that, that more apprenticeships would be available? I mean, I always thought the apprenticeship was a wonderful concept.
I think they're great. Right. I think they're great. They're not necessarily tied to unions or any of that. Apprenticeships, I mean, Germany does that very well. Many countries do. And I've known students in Germany, for example, who have trained to be servers in restaurants. Very professional. Or tellers in banks or whatever.
Yeah.
Now, the real question then becomes what happens when you have only ATM machines and no more tellers and right. so on. So we're in a transition that really is quite – people have to be more
agile. That's a big problem, especially if you've got children just ready to graduate from something.
Sure.
I mean, I remember going to Norway and there was a scientific meeting and then we went to a restaurant and some of my friends were amazed that the young lady that was serving us was not a student. Right? It was her job, right? But – you know, when you realize what you paid for the meal, which you wouldn't pay here, you realize that that person was getting a different level of remuneration. Don't have a lot of time, but I'd like to come to an issue of what we will call multidisciplinary education. All right? I mean, you read a lot about some of these private schools where it's so simple to graduate with a joint degree and say, and I'll just say, physics and finance. They go together, physics and finance, right?
Alliteration, right?
Yes,
nice.
Onomatopoeia also, it's smooth enough. But that's not so easy in state schools, right? Do you see a role for a president like yourself to be able to sort of push against the colleges of this, that, and the other that are very protective and say, look, fellas, ladies, open up a little bit. Let's have more of the true interdisciplinary degree as opposed to just a catch-all degree for people who haven't made up their mind what their major is.
Well, I mean, I think we are seeing more interdisciplinary efforts. I think people are reaching out because they understand that many issues are not solved by one set of facts or knowledge or whatever it might be. And so people are coming together around environmental science or around material science or whatever it might be and coming together. I just saw a very nice piece about an individual who gave money to a school to provide for a more humanitarian engineering degree. And this is an endowment that he made to this institution. And I think more and more people are thinking about those connections and how to encourage them. But I also think that we're at a point in our society where the problem isn't so simple as to say that the people in certain colleges are trying to guard their domains and protect their interests, because we now have so many rules and regulations about how many hours a student is allowed to take to complete a degree. And if you exceed that number by a certain number, you are then penalized for that.
You don't get the funding.
And so, I mean, there are disincentives built into, unfortunately, the structure of public higher education. And they're always done for what I suppose are good reasons, but they usually turn out to have these negative impacts. And so I think, you know, it's a complicated problem and really gets to the point of what is education and who should determine and how should we determine the pathways that various students take. So I think, you know, in the public sector, the return on investment has become a very strong motivator.
Are you familiar with colleges where the student designs their own program? What do you think about that? What do you know? Because I don't know many of this. Is that a successful in the end?
Well, I mean, I think it works sometimes, but sometimes it probably doesn't. And I think it a lot depends on who's guiding, providing advice, whether the student is seeking advice. I think that one could ask, you know, all of these successful tech leaders around the country,
they've
all
school
left
without
school.
Degrees.
Should we say that that's a good idea?
Right.
Well, it could be for them, but it could not be for many others. So,
right.
I mean, these are all balance questions. You know, you got to take a look at this in terms of kind of a greater whole and try to achieve some kind of balance.
But on a day-to-day basis, I see a lot of rigidity in programs. I mean, I must say that.
Well, and I must say
anything a president can do to make people loosen up a little.
Well, of course, I would agree, and I would say the same thing to the legislature and to others, that performance measures and constant assessment in very strict ways really reduce creativity and innovation and force us all into single molds, which aren't necessarily right for every institution or every student.
And I must say I omitted to let the audience know that recently our president was awarded an accolade of one of the 100 most influential people in the world. And that was by Time magazine. Have you got that around your head yet?
No, I find it somewhat, just amazing. I mean, I thought at first I couldn't believe it. And,
right.
You know.
And you looked at the list.
It's just, yeah.
Any other educators? I haven't looked at the list.
I don't recall any. There may be. I'm not recalling any. The list really contains two different kinds of people, celebrities
right.
and influencers, people who are behind the scenes more, not that presidents are behind the scenes, but less visible than celebrities.
Right. That's it for Science Studio. Dana, thank you very much for coming.
My pleasure always.
And I'd like to thank Dennis Wu for putting this program together. Thank you for being there and keep listening. Bye-bye.